changed the title round, was Marx ever a Leninist? Which of course is a silly question, since Lenin was only 13 when Marx died in 1883, and the two never met. Though it is possible to envisage a meeting between Marx and young Lenin at the age of 13, but in fact it never did happen. Now, Lenin considered himself to be a Marxist and saw nothing incompatible between Marx's views and his own view that a minority vanguard party could seize power in the course of a bourgeois revolution and try to turn it into a socialist revolution. I mean, indeed, he probably sincerely believed that this was Marx's view. Now, if Lenin seriously believed this was the case, then this means that he didn't simply make things up. It implies that there must have been something there for him to distort, some at least superficially plausible basis for him not to regard what he was doing as a distortion. Now, after Marx became a socialist in 1843, he was politically active in two periods of his life. When I say politically active, I mean he was an active member of a political organization. And these two periods, the first of them was from 1846 until 1852, and the second was from 1864 to 1873. But he was politically active under two quite different conditions. In the 1840s, Germany had yet to undergo its bourgeois revolution, which was a revolution that would bring the capitalist class of factory owners and merchants to power in place of the semi-feudal landed aristocracy and an absolutist monarch. But in the 1860s, Marx was in Britain, was working with British and other trade unionists and political activists interested in running what amounted to a trade union, not to say reformist international that we talked about yesterday. Now, Lenin, naturally, since conditions in Tsarist Russia were more akin to 1840s Germany than 1860s Europe, was more interested in Marx's first period of political activity, when Marx was essentially a socialist active in a pre-bourgeois revolutionary situation. And in fact, most of Marx's writings from this period, including the Communist Manifesto, were concerned with the tactics which socialists should adopt in the course of a bourgeois revolution. Now, you've already noticed, I've used the word bourgeois, I'll be using other words, bourgeoisie, petty bourgeoisie, proletariat, and words like that, which we in the Socialist Party don't normally use. I would only justify doing this on the grounds that, in fact, this is what Marx himself used. But in fact, the English word for bourgeoisie is capitalist class, and the English word for proletariat is a working class. So I'm going to use the same terms that Marx himself used at the time. Now, Marx's basic position was that socialists or communists, as most socialists, including Marx, then called themselves, he argued that socialists should support the struggle of the bourgeoisie to win political power from absolutist rulers and should virtually act as its extreme left wing. In other words, they should demand a democratic republic instead of the constitutional monarchy, which was advocated by the moderates. But after the bourgeoisie had come to power, what socialists do is they should urge workers to wage a political class struggle against them, to begin their own struggle to get control of political power. Now, Marx adhered to this position fairly strictly, even to the extent of criticizing those socialists who argued either that workers should oppose the bourgeoisie politically, even before the latter had won political power, and against those who argue that workers should concentrate on the economic struggle over wages and working conditions and let the bourgeoisie fight their own political battles. Now, in the context of Tsarist Russia, this would have made Marx more of a Menshevik than a Bolshevik. And the Mensheviks were the non-Leninist wing of the Russian Social Democratic Movement. And they argued that pre-1917 Russia was ripe only for a bourgeois revolution. However, for appeared beginning, I don't know, the end of 1847 till the middle of 1850, Marx did believe that there was a real possibility that the German bourgeois revolution could turn into, or could in fact be turned into, a proletarian revolution, as a revolution in which the proletariats would come to control political power. Now, once again, I've used a word which we wouldn't normally use, proletarian revolution, and it shouldn't be understood in the same sense which we use the word socialist revolution, in other words, a revolution that would lead directly to the establishment of socialism. I mean, Marx used it as to mean a political revolution which would bring the proletariat, the working class, to control political power, even if they couldn't establish socialism immediately. In fact, he knew perfectly well, in the conditions prevailing in 1848, the immediate establishment of communism and socialism, the same thing, was impossible, but he believed that some inroads could be made into capitalist property rights and capitalist conditions of production, that these could be made and they could be gradually extended. I mean, this of course meant that he was committed to the concept of a more or less lengthy transition period of proletarian rule, which again is something that Lenin was able to latch onto. Now, it is from some of Marx's writings from this period that Lenin was able to convince himself that his tactics in 1917 had something to do with Marx, had some basis in Marx's views. Now, the Communist Manifesto itself puts forward the view that the coming bourgeois revolution in Germany would be followed by a proletarian revolution. I mean, the actual title of the manifesto was the Manifesto of the Communist Party. Of course, this had nothing to do with the various parties that sprung up after 1917 in most countries of the world, which called themselves the Communist Party. In fact, in 1848, the word party wasn't understood in its a modern sense of an organization with its own structure and its own membership. At that time, it meant essentially a current of opinion. And this was the sense in which it was meant in the title, that it should be party with a small p, but of course in German all nouns start with a capital, so it didn't translate all that accurately. But actually the name by which the it's known today, the Communist Manifesto, is in today's conditions more accurate than its actual title of the Manifesto of the Communist Party. But having said this, the manifesto, it was the manifesto of a specific organization. It was a manifesto of the Communist League of Germany, of which Marx and Engels were members. Now, Marx's views on what was likely to happen in Germany and what socialists there should do is comes right at the end of the Communist Manifesto. Now, as the passage, as the whole passage has been distributed, I'll only read the last part of it, and this is what Marx wrote. Communists turn their attention chiefly to Germany because that country is on the eve of a bourgeois revolution that is bound to be carried out under more advanced conditions of European civilization and with a much more developed proletariat than that of England was in the 17th and of France in the 18th century, and because the bourgeois revolution in Germany will be but the prelude to an immediately following proletarian revolution. Now, Marx and the Communist League soon had a chance to test this theory that the bourgeois revolution in Germany will be but the prelude to an immediately following proletarian revolution. In February 1848, a revolution in Paris overthrew the king there and established a democratic republic. In March, there were street battles in Berlin, in Vienna, and in Milan, which was then part of Austria. And in Berlin, the King of Prussia was forced to allow the election of a National Assembly to draw up a constitution, which would have been the first step towards turning Prussia into a constitutional monarchy. Now, at the time of the February Revolution in France, Marx was living in Brussels, but he was expelled to France, where he had lived before, and in fact he was welcomed there with honours as citizen Marx. Now, with the outbreak of the German Revolution in March, which was only a month later, Marx moved to Germany. He didn't move to the capital city, Berlin, but to Cologne in the Rhineland, which might seem at first sight an odd choice, but there were two reasons for this choice. One was that the Rhineland had been occupied by Napoleon's troops and feudalism had been abolished there, and the basic law was the Napoleonic Code, which allowed more freedom and organization of the freedom of organization, freedom of the press, freedom of speech and so on, than in Prussia proper, even though the Rhineland was formed part of the Kingdom of Prussia. Now, the second reason was that Marx had been politically active there before, in 1842 and 1843, when he was the editor of a Cologne paper called the Rheinische Zeitung, the Rheinische Gazette. Now, this was before he had become a socialist and was still only a Republican Democrat. But even democratic views were too much for the Prussian authorities, and Marx left Paris, at least left Cologne to go to France and settled in Paris, where he met Parisian workers and completed his conversion to socialist ideas. So incidentally, refuting another one of Lenin's views, that socialist ideas had to be brought to the workers, first of all, by bourgeois intellectuals. In fact, it was the other way around. Marx, the bourgeois intellectual, learned socialist ideas from German and French workers in Paris. Now, when Marx returned to Cologne in 1848, his idea was to revive the Rheinische Zeitung as a daily paper, to be called, not only enough, the Neue Rheinische Zeitung, the new Rheinische Gazette, but to agitate for democracy, i.e. a democratic republic, but also, i.e. not socialism. In the subtitle of the paper, the first issue, which appeared in June 1848, was precisely Organ of Democracy. Now, this, as I say, was in accordance with Marx's general political position, that socialists should first help the bourgeoisie destroy absolutism and feudalism before beginning the political struggle against them. So in practice, the Neue Rheinische Zeitung acted as the voice of the extreme left wing of the radical section of the bourgeoisie. And in fact, Marx, he had dual membership of the Communist League and also of the Democratic Association. Now, as editor, most of Marx's time was taken up with the routine task of bringing out a daily paper. Most of the articles were in fact written not by him, but by Engels. Now, Engels later explained that although the members of the Communist League knew what was going on in Germany in 1848 and 1849 was essentially a bourgeois revolution, the only model they had to go on was the French Revolution, particularly the period in 1793 to 94 when Robespierre and the Jacobins were in power. There had in fact been two revolutions in France. The first in 1789 with the storming of the Bastille led to the establishment of a constitutional monarchy, and the second in 1792, which eventually led to the establishment of a republic, the execution of the king, and the waging of a revolutionary war against the feudal and absolutist states of Europe. Now, Engels, in his articles, called for the German bourgeois revolution to follow the same course as the French Revolution, to move on from the constitutional monarchy stage to the more radical stage of dictatorship, terror, and revolutionary war. Now, the Engels was calling for a strong central government, centralized government in fact, that would use terror against the old ruling classes and their supporters and wage a revolutionary war against Russia can be clearly seen from the following three quotes, which I will give. The first appeared in the paper on the 14th of September 1848. It's what Engels wrote. Every state which finds itself in a provisional situation after a revolution requires a dictator, an energetic dictator at that. On the 7th of November, 1848 again, he wrote, there is only one way of shortening, simplifying and concentrating the murderous death pangs of the old society, the bloody birth pangs of the new, only one way, revolutionary terrorism. And in the 16th of February, 1849, he wrote, hatred of the Russians was and still is the first revolutionary passion of the Germans. We can only secure the revolution against these Slav peoples by the most decisive acts of terrorism. Now, it's not clear what these acts of terrorism he was advocating should be used against the Czechs and the Croats were. It's probably as well, in fact, that we don't ask, because to a socialist today, such views are unacceptable, even shocking. But Engels, as we shall see later, downplayed their significance, attributing them to an erroneous assessment of the conditions of the time. But of course, they were music to Lenin's ears and provided a superficial justification for his own practice after 1917 of dictatorship and terror. But one thing that Lenin ignored was that Engels was talking about what should happen in the course of a bourgeois revolution, and not about what should happen in the course of a proletarian or a socialist revolution. And he and Marx had already developed a theory of the significance of the terror during a bourgeois revolution. They said it was something that was necessary to wage to wipe out feudalism, but which, because the bourgeoisie itself was too timid or too respectable to do this themselves, it's a task that fell to more radical groups within society. In an article that Marx wrote in October 1847, this is, for instance, in what he wrote: "The terror in France could thus, by its mighty hammer blows, only serve to spirit away, as it were, the ruins of feudalism from French soil. The timidly considerate bourgeoisie would not have accomplished this task for decades. The bloody action of the people thus only prepared the way for it," the bourgeoisie. And Engels said more or less the same thing in one of the articles he wrote in the Neue Rheinische Zeitung in December 1848. He said, "Where in the course of a bourgeois revolution the proletariat and other sections of the town population which didn't form part of the bourgeoisie," he said, "where these people stood in opposition to the bourgeoisie, as for example in 1793 and 1794 in France, they were in fact fighting for the implementation of the interests of the bourgeoisie, although not in the manner of the bourgeoisie. The whole of the French terror was nothing other than the plebeian manner of dealing with the enemies of the bourgeoisie, with absolutism, feudalism, and parochialism." Now, this didn't mean that Marx and particularly Engels didn't support such decisive action against feudalism and the old ruling class and its supporters, but they saw this as a necessary stage through which a bourgeois revolution had to pass if it was to deal decisively with feudalism and clear the way for the free development of capitalism, and also, of course, far decades, and more importantly, for the proletariat to be able to begin to wage the political class struggle against the bourgeoisie. So I think this does provide some clues as to how they thought a bourgeois revolution might develop into a proletariat, which remember, was the basic premise which was stated at the end of the Communist Manifesto. Now, Engels, nearly 50 years later, in 1895, in an introduction to a re-edition of some of Marx's writings from the period called The Class Struggles in France, which incidentally sort of where John is from the SLP in America, I've got, you know, their edition of the thing, which they published called The Revolutionary Act. But in this introduction, which Engels wrote in 1895, which is some 47, 48 years later, he suggested that what revolutionary socialists like himself had thought at the time was that whereas in 1794 the bourgeoisie had got rid of the radicals once they'd done the dirty work of eliminating feudalism and its supporters for them, in 1848 it could be different. Socialists could get the proletariat to push the revolution even further and turn it from a minority bourgeois revolution, which would have been even in its a radical phase, into a majority proletarian revolution. Now, two reasons were given for supposing that the outcome in 1848 could be different from what it had been in 1794, both of which are mentioned in the Communist Manifesto. One was the existence of a more developed and politically advanced working class. The other was the presence and the intervention of revolutionary socialists who understood what was going on. But we don't need to rely on Engels' reminiscences of 47 years later. There exists a document that was drafted by Marx on behalf of the Central Committee of the Communist League, which is known simply as the Address of the Central Committee to the Communist League, March 1850, which is explicit enough on this. The German bourgeois revolution didn't succeed. On the contrary, in November 1848, the counter-revolution won a decisive victory. The National Assembly in Berlin was dissolved, and in reply, the more radical members called for a tax strike, which Marx and the Neue Rheinische Zeitung fully supported. You can see the tax strike wasn't a working class weapon, it was a weapon of the bourgeoisie. And in fact, Marx later went on trial in Cologne for calling for this tax strike, and he was acquitted by the good bourgeois of Cologne. But things got worse, and in May 1849, the last issue of the Neue Rheinische Zeitung appeared. It was printed in red. Now Marx went into exile, first in France and then in England, where he settled. Engels went on to fight in the barricade in South Germany. So, I mean, whatever you can say about Engels, he wasn't just all talk. And when this was put down, he went to Switzerland and himself ended up in England. Now, first, Marx Engels and the other members of the Central Committee of the Communist League, you know, exiled in London, they refused to believe that it was all over. In fact, that they thought that the bourgeois revolution was going to break out again soon in Germany, and once again that it would soon be followed, immediately followed, by a proletarian revolution. And the March 1850 address advances this view, arguing that once the working class had helped the bourgeoisie against feudalism and absolutism, they would refuse to hand over their arms, and they should organize workers' councils in working class districts, and that socialists should encourage them to raise ever more radical demands. And in fact, they give us an example. If the radical Democrats demand that the landowners be bought out with compensation, the communists and socialists should demand that they be bought out without compensation. And Marx and the Central Committee of the Communist League, they called this a policy of permanent revolution. This was, of course, or is, of course, a phrase which is used by Trotsky and the Trotskyists. And in fact, this is where Trotsky got the word from. And the address was also a favorite of Lenin's for obvious reasons, because it appeared to provide some justification for the policy of socialists trying to win power in the course of a bourgeois revolution. Actually, we don't need to be mealy-mouthed about this and say appear to justify Lenin's policy. It didn't just appear to justify it, it more or less did. But unfortunately for Lenin, before the year 1850 was out, Marx realized that his assessment had been completely mistaken, that the bourgeois revolution was not going to break out again in the near future. He said you have to wait for the next economic crisis for that to happen. And it was merely revolutionary romanticism for socialists to continue to think in terms of the proletariat winning power in the immediate future. Now this change of attitude on the part of Marx Engels, and in fact the majority of the members of the Central Committee of the Communist League, it led to a split in the organization. And the issue was precisely about whether or not a proletarian revolution was on the cards. The minutes of the meeting of the Central Committee of the 15th of September 1850 refer to a discussion at a previous meeting on the subject of the position of the proletariat in the next revolution, and record the views of Marx and of Karl Schäpper, one of the minority on the Central Committee. And the minutes make interesting, I think, anyway, amusing reading. I mean, Marx starts off by criticizing his opponents. He says, "The will, rather than actual conditions, was stressed as the chief factor in the revolution," which in fact was a mistake that Lenin and people like Mao Zedong were to make later on. "We tell the workers, if you want to change conditions and make yourself capable of government, you will have to undergo 15, 20, or 50 years of civil war." It doesn't necessarily literally mean civil war, it means civil struggle. "Now they're told, we must come to power immediately, or we might as well go to sleep." To which Schäpper replied, "It boils down to whether we do the beheading at the outset, or whether we are ourselves beheaded. The workers will have their turn in France, and thereby we will in Germany. If that was not the case, I would indeed take to my bed." And Marx replies, "We are devoted to a party which would do best not to assume power just now. The proletariat if it comes to power, would not be able to implement proletarian measures immediately. It would have to introduce petty bourgeois ones. Our party can only become the government when conditions allow its views to be put into practice. Louis Blanc provides the best example of what happens when power is assumed prematurely. Now, Engels, in a long article written about the same time, which was later published as a separate pamphlet called The Peasant War in Germany, developed the same argument about what would happen in the event of a premature capture of power, even using the same example of Louis Blanc, who was a member of the French provisional government that took over when King Louis Philippe was kicked out in France in February 1848. Now, the whole of this passage is on the piece of paper that you've got in front of you. I'll just read the key part of it. He says, well, Engels wrote, "The worst thing that can befall a leader of an extreme party is to be compelled to take over a government when society is not yet ripe for the domination of the class he represents and for the measures which that domination implies. What he can do depends not on his will, but upon the level of development of the material means of existence, of the conditions of production and commerce upon which class contradictions always repose." And he comes to the conclusion, Kuznick ends up in his position, is compelled to represent not his party or his class, but the class for whose domination the movement is then ripe. About Marx, in the article already quoted before from October 1847, that said the same thing. It's from this piece of paper that I've recently, a short one. "If, therefore, the proletariat overthrows the political rule of the bourgeoisie, its victory will only be temporary, only an element in the service of the bourgeois revolution itself, as in the year 1794, as long as in the course of history, its movement and the material conditions have not yet been created, which makes necessary the abolition of the bourgeois mode of production, and therefore also the definitive overthrow of the political rule of the bourgeoisie." Now, these two quotes were put to very effective use by the Mensheviks to criticize the Bolsheviks and to develop a theory based on Marx's views of what was happening in Russia in 1917. As they said, in 1917, in Russia, a bourgeois revolution was taking place, in the course of which the Bolsheviks seized power in a bid to promote a socialist revolution. But because the conditions were not ripe for a socialist revolution or for socialism, all that would happen is that the Bolshevik rule would merely be an element in the service of the bourgeois revolution itself. This is the argument put forward by the Menshevik Martov in the pamphlet, The State and Socialist Revolution, which we like so much. Now, the Bolsheviks certainly did live up to the terror of 1794. The Tsar of Russia went the same way as Charles I and Louis the 16th, and many other supporters of the old regime were also executed or put in concentration camps. And in fact, the whole Tsarist social order was completely uprooted. I mean, you know, one thing the Russian Revolution did do, and the Bolshevik seizure of power, they completely eliminated feudalism in Russia. But in the end, this theory didn't turn out to be an entirely adequate one, because it assumed that, well, I mean, the people who, you know, who put it forward, contrary to what they expected, and some Mensheviks and Social Democrats expected this to happen still as late as 1921, contrary to what they expected, Bolshevik rule was not overthrown and replaced by that of the bourgeoisie. I mean, it was eventually, but that was 80 years later. But instead, what happened was the Bolsheviks, they stayed in power and evolved into a new ruling class themselves. And what developed in Russia was not private capitalism after a more or less short period of Bolshevik rule and terror against Tsarism, but a new form of capitalism under state ownership and control, which was not seen before, which in fact wasn't anticipated by Marx in the 19th century. Now, nevertheless, these two passages do provide the basis for an explanation as to why the Bolshevik Revolution, insofar as it can be seen as an attempt to make a move towards socialism, was bound to fail, and for why the Bolshevik leaders would end up as the servants and not as the masters of objective material conditions. What Marx and Engels were in effect saying was that conditions in 1848 and 1850 were not ripe for what Marx sometimes called, as I mentioned yesterday, the dictatorship of the proletariat. Now, this was a phrase borrowed from French revolutionary socialists of the time, but to which Marx gave a more democratic content. In fact, in April 1950, the Communist League joined with some French revolutionary socialists, or Blanquistes, were envisaged as being exercised by the people through their democratically elected representatives, which Marx did envisage. This could only legitimately be called the dictatorship of the proletariat if the word proletariat was stretched to include the petit bourgeoisie and the peasantry. But this was precisely one of the criticisms that when the split developed in the Communist League that Marx had made a shepherd when he said this: the word proletariat has been reduced to a mere phrase like the word people was by the Democrats. To make this phrase a reality, one would have to declare the entire petty bourgeoisie to be proletarians, i.e. de facto represent the petty bourgeoisie and not the proletariat. So here again Marx was saying that conditions weren't ripe for the rule of the proletariat, and that an attempt to do this would lead to the rule either of or on behalf of those he called the petty bourgeoisie. In 1850, he was in effect saying that even the dictatorship of the proletariat as the beginning of some transition to socialism, let alone socialism itself, was not possible. Now Engels' comments in 1895 in this introduction that he wrote to something Marx's class struggles in France can serve as an epitaph to the illusions that he and Marx had entertained in what might be called their Leninist phase from 1848 to 1850 about an immediately following proletarian revolution. This is what Engels wrote: "History has proved us and all who thought like us wrong. It has made clear that the state of economic development on the continent at that time was not by a long way ripe for the elimination of capitalist production." And then later on in the same introduction: "The time is past for revolutions carried through by small minorities at the head of unconscious masses. When it gets to be a matter of the complete transformation of the social organization, the masses themselves must participate, must understand what is at stake and why they are to act. That much the history of the last 50 years has taught us, but so that the masses may understand what is to be done, long and persistent work is required." So sometime between April and September 1850, Marx came to the conclusion that not only were conditions not ripe for a proletarian revolution, in British commas or not, at that time, but that precisely because of this, it was a mistake to try for one, because even if socialists were to come to power, they would not be able to serve the interests of the working class, nor to further the cause of socialism. All they would be able to do would be to serve the interests of a section of the bourgeoisie of the capitalist class and to further the development of capitalism. Now this represented a repudiation of his previous views, which were those that Lenin latched onto to justify the Bolshevik serious seizure of power in November 1917, and in fact represented a powerful and a quite far-sighted criticism of it. So to conclude, we can say in answer to the question, was Marx a Leninist, is that he did flirt with Leninist type ideas for a while, but then abandoned them and always afterwards opposed them in favour of the long and protracted process of working class self-organisation, which would eventually lead to workers being ready to win political control and to establish socialism.